The following is a production of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary, visit us online at gpts.edu.
The great thing about the cover of this book is that it actually doubles as a cover for Hodge. I also actually think Hodge sort of got the last laugh on Nevin, because you can find portraits of Hodge that look exactly like this. And I sometimes think they got mixed up, but anyway. And also, I would encourage you not to buy the McGoldrick book, because it would be discouraging to me. I just finished the Global History of Calvinism, and I'm shocked to learn that such a book exists. I bring you greetings from Romney country. It's also a country that sent, I'm teaching a course on the history of college. I don't need this, do I? I'm sorry. Okay. And Hillsdale College was radically abolitionist in its origins. And the state, Michigan, sent more able-bodied men into the war of northern aggression, or civil war, or war between the states, depending on your perspective, than any other. So the greetings come perhaps as a mixed bag, though I would have not thought that the South would vote so solidly Republican and for Roman Catholic candidates to boot, which is a good way to introduce what I'm going to talk about, which is 19th century cross currents, because with history, you can never predict how it's going to turn out. It's not inevitable how it would turn out. We are here at this conference, and I apologize for not being here earlier. Wanting to keep this job, I kept teaching through this yesterday afternoon. But we are here to commemorate and celebrate, in many respects, the legacy of old Princeton. And so in a talk like this, where I'm speaking on Charles Hodge and Charles Finney and John Nevin, it might be expected of me to come out on the side of Hodge and to promote his legacy. But historians do not do celebration well, and we know perhaps the clay feet of figures. We also know that perhaps history didn't always turn out the way we'd want it to turn out. And so it's important to remember, I think, that in the long term or long perspective of this the debates that went on among Hodge, Finney, and Nevin, that Finney really didn't necessarily win the debate, but he came out on top within the history of American Protestantism. And to back that up, I will appeal to Mark Knoll, who in his History of the United States, Christianity in the United States and Canada, writes this about Finney. Because of his dominant role in the revival tradition and the dominant place that revivalism assumed in the antebellum period, a good case can be made that Finney should be ranked with Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and Andrew Carnegie as one of the most important figures in 19th century America, public figures, that is. Beyond doubt, he stands by himself as the crucial figure in white American evangelicalism after Jonathan Edwards. In fact, a good case can be made that Finney exerted a more significant influence on American life, and certainly on American religion, than such other key figures as Ralph Waldo Emerson, the political statesman Daniel Webster, the educational reformer Horace Mann, and the historian Henry Adams. But in 1850, Protestants did not know this. It's arguable that no one knew what the landscape would be after these figures lived. And maybe it's the case that historians still don't know. In preparing for this, something I like to do is go to the American National Biography, which is the standard biographical reference work in the United States. And it's interesting just to keep tabs on how many words the editors allot to different figures. And in this comparison, Hodge comes out on top with 2,900 words. Finney only got 2,300 words. And Nevin comes in way down, just like Romney did last night, with 1,400 words. And the reason why this biographical work may not take Finney as seriously as they should is partly because Knoll wrote the biographical entry on Hodge and not on Finney, but also because I think there's still a bias against revivalists within the historical guild. So it's still the case, though, that it's not inevitable that Finney would prevail or be decisive for American Protestantism. The American mainstream of Protestantism was still up for grabs, and it was even up for grabs among Presbyterian and Reformed communions. The PCUSA, the sponsoring agency of Princeton Seminary, and the seminary itself were not the only options even when it came to Presbyterianism in the United States. So there really were cross currents going on in the 19th century, and Hodge and Finney and Nevin all swam in those currents and in some cases tried to redirect them. But I think overall the tide was moving in Finney's direction. And to withstand the flood, Hodge and Nevin registered some very important warnings that we need to pay attention to. So what I would like to do today, in this hour ahead, is look at the context of the careers of these figures. First of all, the ecclesiastical context, just to sort of get an orientation of Reformed Protestantism in the United States, but also at the institutional context, particularly the history of theological education in the United States. So that's one point. Then I want to give a brief overview of their careers, and I hope not to repeat too much of what Nick presented this morning on Hodge. I'll try to abbreviate my remarks there. Then I want to touch a little bit on the debates that ensued among, first between Hodge and Nevin against Finney, and then what resulted in a debate between Hodge and Nevin over the nature of Reformed Protestantism. And then finally, I want to comment on the significance of these debates for Reformed Protestantism in America. So first of all, the context, particularly the ecclesiastical context. Presbyterianism was not the only game in town in North America in the 19th century. Hodge himself was part of one branch of Presbyterians, the PCUSA. Finney, which we may not always remember, got his start also among that same body, the Presbyterian Church in the USA. But his theological roots were probably more in New England and New England Congregationalism. What similarities it bore to Puritanism is another question beyond the scope of this paper. And then Nevin also started as a Presbyterian, a PCUSA man, but migrated into the German Reformed Church. And that's really one of the oddest quirks in American church history, in my estimation, is for someone to go ethnic like that, to leave, even though the Presbyterians were ethnic as well, Scotch-Irish and Scottish, with some English thrown in. But to go non-Anglo was really quite remarkable. So that's one way of trying to get some orientation on this. It's also important to see that at the end of the 17th century, the leading exporters of Reformed Protestantism in the world were the Dutch, the Germans, and the Scots. They were the most vital churches by the end of the 17th century, and those churches sent, for whatever reasons, migrants to North America. So we're seeing some of the cross-currents even coming out of Europe playing out in North America. Now, the oldest of those communions in what would become the United States were the Dutch Reformed. The Dutch Reformed established churches in what had been known as New Amsterdam or New Netherland all the way back in the 1620s. The first minister didn't come until 10 years after the colony in 1624. And what was striking about the Dutch development is the Dutch Reformed were always under the oversight of the classes of Amsterdam all the way back in the Old World. And this is very different from the Presbyterian pattern of the PCUSA. There was no mother church for Presbyterians the way there was a mother church for the Dutch Reformed. The Dutch Reformed persisted between 1624 and 1664 as the established church of New Amsterdam and New Netherland, but then when the English kicked out the Dutch, the Dutch Reformed had to come to terms with the English. And coming to terms with the English also was difficult at times, but the English actually saw the advantage of keeping the Dutch Reformed churches intact. They raised taxes to support those Dutch Reformed churches and even treated them as an informal establishment there. So that pattern the predominance of the Dutch Reformed in New York would persist into the 18th century, even after the English finally started to send out the Church of England started to send out missionaries to try to plant churches in New York. In the 18th century, as was the case with most Reformed communions, And also Lutheran communions, there were tensions over revivals of the 18th century. Everyone knows is the first Great Awakening. I think it's better maybe to render it the first Pretty Good Awakening. And I take that from a friend and colleague of mine who teaches at George Washington University, who gave a talk in China about the history of religion in America. And he also is baffled by the use of the word great that we attach to these awakenings, so he called it the first Pretty Good Awakening. So there were disputes among the Dutch over those awakenings, and those Dutch who were most attached to the old world were suspicious of the revival's novelty, and we'll talk about this more. But it wasn't finally until 1772 that the Dutch Reformed in America established their own independence. Independence was in the air in the 1770s. And so they finally gained their own autonomy and had their own institutions, whether classes or synods, and then in 1792 became a separate denomination, the Reformed Church in America. So that's a very different history, though, from what happened among the Presbyterians. The Presbyterians who founded Princeton Theological Seminary were the oldest formal Reformed communion in North America, with the Presbytery going all the way back to 1776 in Philadelphia. It's the first presbytery in the New World. By 1717, these Presbyterians had created four presbyteries and one synod. And in 1729, they finally got around to adopting the Westminster Confession and Catechisms as the doctrinal standard for the church. The Presbyterians also experienced conflicts over the First Great Awakening, Pretty Good Awakening. They split into the old and new side branches in 1741, and they would remain separate for 17 years. And in 1758, the Plan of Union reunited the old side and new side, and I'll talk more about that reunion tomorrow, even though I'm talking about the end of Princeton, because I do think it bears on that. So finally, after 80 years of having a presbytery and synods, only after 80 years did Presbyterians get around to having their first General Assembly, which met in Philadelphia in 1789. Philadelphia really is the capital of Presbyterianism in North America. But even after the formation of the General Assembly, the PCOSA lacked a theological center, or they lacked theological coherence, even after adopting the Westminster Standards. And you can see this in the Plan of Union of 1801, which was an arrangement between Congregationalists and Presbyterians for planting churches out in the Wild West in places like Michigan, where I now dwell, in the Northwest Territory. The Presbyterians and Congregationalists were going to cooperate in planting churches in Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois. And the Plan of Union laid out how that would work administratively. And the aim of this was to supply religion for the new nation, but it also meant theological compromise, which is what was going to lead to the controversies in which Hodge and Finney participated. So that's just a little bit of background on American Presbyterianism, but we don't want to think that those Presbyterians are the only Presbyterians in North America, because in the 18th century, the Covenanters and the Seceders also established presbyteries in North America, and we sometimes forget about them. And if you pull into view the North America and think about Presbyterianism in Canada, Canada is overrun with the various churches from Scotland, the Covenanters, the Seceders, the Kirk, and eventually even the Free Church. So Canadian Presbyterianism bears all the fingerprints of developments in Scotland in ways that America does not. So this brings us lastly, then, as far as ecclesiastical orientation, to the German Reformed. And here it's a very similar story in some ways to the American Presbyterians, but also in similarities with the Dutch. So Reformed Protestants from Germany began to come to North America as part of the Great European Migration in the 17th and 18th centuries, but they also came to escape real persecution. And Pennsylvania was a welcome place for many Germans of all kinds of varieties. William Penn and the Quakers were religiously tolerant in ways that many of the other colonies weren't. And so these German Reformed Protestants came to North America, and they came without ecclesiastical supervision or without clergy. And in fact, their first minister, John Baim, came to the New World with no plans to be a pastor. He had been a teacher. His father had been a pastor. And people saw that what his background was, and they made him a minister. And he began to perform the work of a minister even without being ordained, which caused him some grief. He finally secured his credentials through the Dutch Reformed in New York. And it was under, here you have not only classes of Amsterdam back in the old country overseeing Dutch Reformed developments, but they were now also overseeing German Reformed developments. So the German Reformed were indebted to the Dutch Reformed in important ways. And it really wasn't until the 1740s that the German Reformed began to form their own ministerial association. And then finally they formed their own synod in 1793, thus establishing the German Reformed Church, which in the 19th century would become the Reformed Church in the U.S. So there's still a successor to that through the Eureka classes. So that's a little bit of orientation of these different Reformed and Presbyterian communions. Now, as far as the institutional background to these developments, and here I have in mind the educational ones, particularly regarding theological seminaries, it wasn't clear until the 19th century what the pattern was for theological training in North America. The colonial colleges, Yale, Harvard, the College of New Jersey, William & Mary, pretty much their curriculum was the liberal arts and the classics. Students who aspired to the ministry would go to these institutions, but they wouldn't receive any instruction in the Bible or theology. You might be able to take a master's degree in one of these institutions in theology, but the undergraduates really had more awareness of Plato and Aristotle and the Peloponnesian Wars than they did of the Westminster Standards or John Calvin. And so what people, ministers, aspiring ministers, would have to do was to go and perform an apprenticeship with an established minister. We know a lot about this from the case of Jonathan Edwards, who had many ministers come study with him, and many of those ministers went out and ministered in the Connecticut River Valley. But this was a pattern that prevailed among all the churches, Reformed churches, in the 18th and early 19th centuries. It was sort of like Labrie before Labrie, but it was designed to train pastors. And then in the 19th century, though, we have this educational innovation of the theological seminary. Seminaries were actually a Roman Catholic institution in origin, but Protestants did something entirely different with the seminary. And Andover was the first seminary in the United States. Andover Seminary founded in 1808, and it was founded in part to counteract the bad doctrine that had happened at Harvard. Harvard was beginning to go Unitarian at that time, and the Orthodox Congregationalists responded with their own seminary. But another reason for starting seminaries was that there were not enough pastors to go around. In 1800, Presbyterians had roughly one pastor for every four congregations. And this is a similar pattern that prevailed in other communions. So there was a real pastoral shortage. The governments, even in the colonies, weren't necessarily trying to recruit pastors to these colonies. And then once the United States starts, the United States government, of course, committed as it is to some kind of religious freedom, isn't going to cultivate pastors. So the denominations took it into their own hands and began to start seminaries. Princeton Seminary was established in 1812 directly for this purpose. And the German Reformed start their own seminary in 1825 with Mercersburg Theological Seminary. And there's an interesting unintended consequence, which has a ironic twist to it, it seems to me. On the one hand, the formation of these seminaries produce a school of thought. The seminaries actually begin to give some kind of theological coherence to their respective denominations. Prior to the rise of seminaries, the denominations' affiliations in North America were loose. That meant the doctrinal coherence was oftentimes sketchy. Each pastor who was training ministers under him in an apprenticeship model could devise a curriculum for prospective pastors, and they could plug into those curricula all the idiosyncrasies that they might have in their own system. But when you have a seminary, you begin to have uniformity of product. And so seminaries begin to give definition to denominations. And so Seminaries weren't the only institutions that gave coherence to these denominations. For instance, in 1831, the Presbyterian Church USA also publishes its first Psalter and Hymnal, or Psalter Hymnal. So mechanisms like that also help to give identity to a denomination, but the seminaries really paved the way for doing this. And, of course, it didn't always succeed. Not all of the graduates from these seminaries turned out the way that their faculty wanted them to, and I'm sure that's still the case even in places like Greenville Seminary and Westminster, California, and Philadelphia. For instance, Albert Barnes, the nemesis of Charles Hodge throughout the old school, new school controversy in the 1830s, was a graduate of Princeton Seminary. But Barnes actually followed teaching at Yale with Nathaniel Taylor more than he did what he had been taught at Princeton Seminary. So it's not exactly going to be the case that seminaries will guarantee theological uniformity within a church or a communion. That's a little bit of background on Princeton. Again, Princeton was founded in 1812. It still is an agency of the General Assembly. Ultimately, there would be other seminaries that would arise in the Presbyterian Church, and these would be founded oftentimes by synods or presbyteries. Princeton, to my understanding, is the only one that was founded by the General Assembly, and that's going to have important repercussions for when we talk about Princeton tomorrow and the demise of Princeton and Machen's role in that, or his getting caught up in that. So that's Princeton. Now just a little bit on Mercersburg. Mercersburg, as I said, started in 1825, and when it actually split the church in 1823, it was actually a free German Reformed church that started because they didn't want a denominational seminary. And Mercersburg struggled mightily at the beginning. It was located first in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where Dickinson College was going to welcome the institution as a sister institution, but that didn't work out. It then moved to York, Pennsylvania, and finally it moved to Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, where the German Reformed Church already had an academy and a college. And then it would make one more move in the 1850s to Lancaster. And today, Lancaster Theological Seminary is that old Mercersburg Seminary. It's important also not to leave Finney out from this educational mix. We think of Finney as a revivalist, but he was also a professor of moral philosophy for 16 years, and he was also the president of Oberlin College, another radically abolitionist school in the North. And so it's important to see that Finney was also responsible for providing a school of thought, which people would call the Oberlin perfectionism. And these schools, like Hillsdale and Oberlin, were undergraduate institutions, but they also provided training for pastors. And so Finney was also a theological educator of a sort. Now, turning to their careers, the second point. Finney is the oldest of the three. He was born in 1792, and he died in 1875. He was born in Warren, Connecticut, the son of Sylvester Finney and Rebecca Rice, who were farmers, and when Finney was two, the family moved to upstate New York, Oneida County. Finney did not receive a lot of education. He attended common school and an academy for a brief time. He also taught school later, but when Princeton was founded in 1812, Finney was only at that time going to an academy in Connecticut, and he was only there for 2 years, and that was the most of his formal training. He thought about going to Yale, but declined. Instead, he taught school in New Jersey from 1814 to 1818, and then decided upon a practice in law, and he was practicing law by 1820. He was active in church in his town of Adams, New York. He actually directed the local Presbyterian church choir. He heard lots of preachers who came through town regularly, revivalists, evangelists, and many suspect that he picked up many of his tricks, if you want to call them that, the new measures, from observing some of these evangelists. He was very much surrounded by a Protestant culture that was oriented toward New England congregationalism, and he heard much through these his hanging around churches about the debates over Calvinism that were occurring within New England Congregationalism. He also studied the Bible on his own. And finally, in 1821, when another revival came through town at the age of 29, Finney converted and pledged his life to become an evangelist. He was eventually licensed to preach by the Presbytery of St. Lawrence in December 1823, and he did an informal form of theological study with the pastor there, George W. Gale, who was a Princeton graduate, and Gale thought that Finney should go to Princeton, which would have put Finney at Princeton at roughly the same time that John Williamson Nevin was starting out as a seminarian. It would have been an interesting collection to see Finney and Nevin in the same class studying under Charles Hodge. That's just one of the amazing quirks of that could have happened in American church history. But Finney didn't like seminaries. This is what he wrote about seminaries in one of his books. The grand defect of seminaries was that seminary graduates were not fit to go into a revival. Seminaries shut students out from intercourse with the common people and trained ministers in irrelevant matters. I would say nothing to undervalue or lead you to undervalue a thorough education for ministers, but I do not call that a seminary education, a thorough education. It does not fit them for their work. I appeal to all experience whether our young men in seminaries are thoroughly educated for the purpose of winning souls. Do they do it? Everybody knows they do not. So any young man filled with the Spirit was worth more than 500 educated ministers. And as you might suspect, Finney didn't win many friends among seminary faculty. In 1824, then, Finney began to work as an evangelist for the Female Missionary Society in the Western District of New York. And then he was finally ordained in 1824 to the work of an evangelist. And for a time, he planted churches and filled the pulpit in various places. But he also, at this point, began to develop what became known as the New Measures, his techniques for conducting a revival. And he would eventually say that a revival was scientific. You just put in the right mix of ingredients and a revival will come out. So, for instance, he preached without notes, which was an innovation at the time. He looked listeners in the eye and addressed them as you. He presented the gospel, some said, as if he were a lawyer before a jury. He also preached the torments or the threats of hell in very vivid language. He began to experience success as an evangelist and revivalist in 1825 in what was known as the Burned Over District in Oneida County. One of the towns where he had his first success was Auburn, New York, the home of Auburn Theological Seminary, which, if you know the history of Princeton Seminary in the 1920s, you want to boo whenever you hear Auburn, because that was where the Auburn Affirmation came from. 2, 3, 4. Okay. Eventually, Finney began to conduct revivals outside of upstate New York, and he went into the heartland of conservative Presbyterianism in 1828 and conducted revivals in Wilmington and Philadelphia. But his greatest notoriety as an evangelist would come in 1831 with an awakening in Rochester, New York. And there he turned for the first time to what was known as the anxious bench, and also the protracted meetings of having meetings go for the course of 4 or 5 days, where people would stop working to come to these revivals. I mean, it really is the beginning of the Billy Graham Crusade sort of model. But the anxious bench was also the beginnings of a formalized altar call, where people would come forward to the beginning, to the front of the church to receive counsel if they felt under conviction. So this was an important turning point, but unlike George Whitefield, who had remarkable stamina for his travels and speaking as an evangelist, Finney did not. So he had to settle down for a while, and he tried to conduct churches in New York City in 1832. He lasted in the pastorate for 4 years before finally moving to Oberlin in Ohio in 1836, where he also transferred to the Congregational Church, probably a couple steps ahead of the old school Presbyterian law that was behind him. That was also meant to be a bit of a joke. And starting in 1851, Finney became the president of Oberlin. And again, Oberlin developed its own school of thought known as this perfectionism. Now, Hodge was the second oldest of this group. He was born 5 years after Finney in 1797, and he lived until 1878, 3 years after Finney's death. Hodge was born in Philadelphia, the son of Hugh Hodge, who was a physician and merchant, and Mary Blanchard, a native of Boston and descendant of prominent patriots. Hodge and his brother Hugh Lennox lost their father when Hodge was only 7 months old to an illness, and so they were reared by their mother, and she moved the boys to Princeton. And maybe Nick went into some of this, so I'll abbreviate this overview of Hodge's life for the sake of time and also for the sake of your interest. But what is important to note was that Hodge, when he went to the College of New Jersey as an undergraduate, had a conversion experience and then made profession of faith. And I want to comment more about conversion experiences, both perhaps Finney's, Hodge's, and Nevin's, but it's striking from this case of Hodge's conversion that a covenant child, and Hodge was a pretty devout boy. He talked in his memoirs about trying to avoid cursing as much as possible and praying repeatedly throughout the days. And yet, even with that kind of religious culture and piety in the home growing up, he still felt compelled that he needed to convert. And I'm just what I want to raise later on is what would he convert from, since he wasn't living the life of someone who was scandalous or wantonly sinful. But there was this expectation for young boys or adolescents to convert. The major influence on Hodge was Archibald Alexander, who was then professor at Princeton Seminary. So great was that influence that Hodge, of course, named his first child Archibald Alexander Hodge. Hodge went to Princeton, graduated from Princeton in 1819. Alexander encouraged him to study languages more. He was eventually licensed by the Presbytery of Philadelphia and ordained a year later in 1820 by the Presbytery, 1821, by the Presbytery of New Brunswick. Why he was licensed in Philadelphia but ordained in New Brunswick is a mystery in some ways. It makes me wonder if Alexander's credentials were still in Philadelphia, because Alexander had been a pastor in Philadelphia before. And maybe the answer to that was in an earlier lecture today. But Hodge would then spend 56 years at Princeton. And during that time, he instructed more than 3,000 students, which is really quite remarkable, the highest number of anyone for any theological professor in the 19th century. He also founded the Princeton Review, originally called the Biblical Repertory and Princeton Review. It went through various names. But it really is a remarkable journal. Have just finished a paper on Princeton's coverage of the disruption in the Church of Scotland in the 1830s and 1840s. And I've been pretty impressed by how well the Princeton faculty covered the disruption and the developments in Scotland. But the Princeton Review covered way more than church history. It covered cultural developments, political developments, and of course Hodge always wrote an annual review of the Presbyterian Church and commenting on the General Assembly. I have here, I can't find the name of the person who wrote this. Well, no, it was the editor of the British Quarterly Review, called the Biblical Repertory, beyond all question, the greatest purely theological review that has ever been published in the English tongue. That was from in 1871. So Hodge really did perform a remarkable service in creating the Princeton Review. His only absence from Princeton was to study in Germany for 2 years, from 1826 to 1828, and there he became familiar with developments in German philosophy and theology. And those developments would have a very different effect on him than they would on Nevin, which then leads me to John Williamson Nevin, the last of these three figures. He's the youngest of the three as well, born in 1803, so he's 6 years younger than Hodge, and he lived until 1886. They all had remarkably long run at a time when life expectancy was not nearly that long. Nevin was born in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, the son of farmers. His father was called a Latin farmer because he was educated at Dickinson College, and he was able to teach his children Latin, Greek, and other subjects. He had 9 children in all. Nevin himself attended a parochial school founded by the Presbyterian Church in Middle Spring, Pennsylvania, and eventually he went to college in 1817 at the age of 14 to Union College in Schenectady, New York, an institution that was much more oriented to congregational developments than it was toward Presbyterian ones. It's not unusual for boys 14 years old to go to college. They were supposed to be adolescents when going to college. Now we have extended adolescence among college students. So this was the norm. Once you could master Latin and Greek, you could go to college pretty much. And Nevin at Union, just like Hodge at the College of New Jersey, was converted during a series of revival meetings. And it was a very unpleasant experience, and we'll talk more about that later. And it would have a very important effect upon Nevin in his reflection on American Presbyterianism. He sort of wandered about for a couple of years, and then he finally enrolled after Union at Princeton Seminary in 1823, again about the same time that Finney might have enrolled there had he taken the advice of his pastor. And when he graduated in 1826, Hodge was at that point leaving for Germany to study in Europe, Germany and beyond, and Nevin actually filled in for those 2 years while Hodge was away. So Nevin was also not just a graduate of Princeton Seminary, but one of the faculty there, which is why I think we should give him more of a break than he generally gets sometimes among conservative Presbyterian circles. And then finally in 1830, he taught at Pittsburgh, or at what was then known as Western Theological Seminary, located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At the time, Pittsburgh was on the frontier of the United States, and the frontier would continue to expand throughout the 19th century, but still, this was very much on the fringes, hence the name Western Theological Seminary. He taught there for 10 years. He began to study German and German theology and German philosophy, and that finally persuaded him to become professor of at Mercersburg Seminary in 1840. And German Reformed kept piling on the duties of Nevin. He also became the president of Marshall College, which would eventually become part of Franklin and Marshall College. And he wore himself out for the next 12 years. In addition to teaching theology at the seminary and running the college, he also, following Hodge's lead, started the Mercersburg Review, which was another important theological journal, especially for making German theology and philosophy available in the English language in North America. And finally, when the seminary and the college moved to Lancaster in 1853, Nevin, who was only 50, retired. He retired partly because of exhaustion, and also because of great spiritual doubts. He contemplated joining the Roman Catholic Church. He never did, perhaps because of his counseling to James Buchanan, who was his neighbor in Lancaster, the 15th president, much maligned president, but the only president from the virtuous Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And so Nevin did remain in the fold. He also returned to work in 1866. So after a 13-year interval, he went back to college teaching and also presided over Franklin and Marshall College, and he retired for the last time in 1876. He also left his mark on the German Reformed Church by helping to devise a liturgy that created great opposition within the church. So that's just an overview of these men's careers. Now, turning to the debates that took place among them. And one thing we need to say here is that Finney really didn't engage in these debates. Finney didn't respond to Hodge and Nevin. And it could be because Hodge and Nevin were responding to Finney in the 1840s when the genie was well out of the bottle. It would have been hard for Nevin and Hodge to respond to Finney earlier because they were young men still establishing their careers. By the 1840s, when they were established in their careers, they began to write about Finney. But they didn't gain a response from Finney. So Nevin led the charge against Finney, and he did so in response to an event, a very uncomfortable event that took place in his life in 1843. The congregation in Mercersbury, the German Reformed congregation, was conducting a pastoral search. And the man who came to town was a graduate of Princeton, I believe, William Ramsey. And he was a friend of Nevin, and he began to preach his sermon, and at the end of the sermon he issued an altar call and started to adopt the new measures that Nevin had used. And Finney had used. Nevin was up on the platform with this man, and he was greatly embarrassed by this. The man eventually asked Nevin into the pulpit to say some more words to encourage the revival that this candidate hoped would be coming, and Nevin, in fact, warned people not to go forward. To make the story even more complicated, the congregation went ahead and called Ramsey as their pastor. But because he knew of Nevin's opposition, he declined the call. So this started Nevin's mind working, and in 1843, very soon thereafter, he published a little book, what I think is one of the great achievements of American church history, called The Anxious Bench. And basically, he criticized Finney's new measures, balling them all up into one ball of The Anxious Bench, and he critiqued it on two levels. The first was the sheer mechanics of the bench. He believed that the altar call actually distracted people from what should have been, they should have been thinking about at that very moment. Instead of reflecting upon their guilt and their sin and their need for repentance and their trust in the Savior, they had to contemplate whether they were going to go get up and walk down the aisle and think about what other people might, how they might see them. So this whole other psychological layer was added on top of what might have been a genuine point of faith and repentance. Having grown up in a Baptist church where altar calls were encouraged, I know what that anxiety was like. And sometimes you even go forward to help the pastor out because the guy is really struggling and he wants someone to come forward, so you come forward and help him. So that's the kind of psychological dimension that might go on here. But then he also critique it on a systematic level, in the sense that he contrasted the bench with the catechism. And the bench stood for the system of revivals and all the techniques that Finney used. And the catechism didn't stand for the Heidelberg Catechism, although that was part of it. The catechism actually stood for a churchly system that was centered in sermons, systematic instruction from the catechism, a pastoral visitation in the homes, church discipline, and faithful and patient perseverance in the details of ministerial work. That was the way to conduct true religion, not through the antics that Finney was proposing with the new measures. And Nevin wrote here in this work, "The spirit of the anxious bench is at war with the spirit of the catechism. Where it comes societally to prevail, catechetical instruction and the religious training of the young generally are not likely to be maintained with much effect, and it will not be strange if they should be openly slighted even and thrust out of the way as an encumbrance to the gospel rather than as a help." So that is Finney's response. His response, and we'll see more of it actually in a few minutes, but that's his main response, is to critique the bench on this level in contrasting it with the catechism. Hodge, a few years after Nevin wrote The Anxious Bench, Hodge wrote a review of Finney's lectures on systematic theology that were published in 1846. The complete title of the work was, and it was very long, "Lectures on Systematic Theology, Embracing Lectures on Moral Government, Together with Atonement, Moral and Physical Depravity, Philosophical Theories, and Evidences of Regeneration." So it gave Hodge a large target. And what Hodge generally did in his review was to critique what he had already seen as excesses in the New School theology or in the New Haven theology, And the two errors that were predominant was the first, the relationship between moral obligation and free will, meaning that just because the Bible requires something doesn't mean that it means God says we have or the Bible teaches that people have free will. And the second error was whether human happiness or the love of being in general is the highest good. And this idea of the love of being in general is an idea that originally developed in Jonathan Edwards and was carried on by the New Divinity movement. So I won't go into the details of this critique because it gets a little technical, and Hodge is especially going after the details of Finney's moral philosophy. And having recently taught through the moral philosophies in a very poor way, I'm sure, but of Francis Whalen, Archibald Alexander, and Noah Porter, three college presidents. Archibald Alexander was also college president of one time of Hampton Sydney College, and college presidents all taught moral philosophy in their senior year to undergraduates. It can get fairly technical, especially the way that moral philosophers use faculty psychology and dissected the mind and the will and the soul in ways that I myself find very abstract and sometimes implausible. Towards the end of the review, though, Hodge finally gets around beyond the moral philosophy questions implicit in Finney's book to Finney's Pelagian theology. And here Hodge wrote, "The Bible nowhere asserts the ability of fallen man to make himself holy. It, in a multitude of places, asserts just the reverse. And all the provisions and promises of grace and all the prayers and thanksgivings for holiness recorded in scriptures take for granted that men cannot make themselves holy. This, therefore, has been and is the doctrine of every Christian church under the sun, unless that of Oberlin be an exception. There is no confession of the Greek, Romish, Lutheran, or Reformed churches in which this is not openly avowed. It was, says Neander, a German theologian, the radical principle of Pelagius' system that he assumed moral liberty to consist in the ability at any moment to choose between good and evil, or as Mr. Finney expresses it, in the power to choose in every instance in accordance with the moral law. It is an undisputed historical fact that this view of liberty has not been adopted in the confession of any one denominational church in Christendom, but is expressly repudiated by them all." In other words, Pelagianism is a heresy, and Finney was still touting the heresy of Pelagius. So there you have the responses of Hodge and Nevin to Finney. One, going after revivals and the kind of piety that they encouraged. The other, going after Finney's theology and philosophy. But this also then set into motion a controversy between Hodge and Nevin. So Nevin continued his reflections on the system of the catechism as opposed to the system of the bench and wanted to recover the importance of the Lord's Supper for Reformed church life. He also looked at the church as mother, as Calvin does in Book 4, and the church as a nurturer. And he thought this was the important vehicle to counteract revivals and their system of piety. Hodge responds then to Nevin with a criticism of his theology. So you have a liturgical streak in Nevin and a doctrinal streak in Hodge. But it started because of Nevin's writing a book called The Mystical Presence of Vindication of the Reformed or Calvinistic Doctrine of the Holy Supper, or the Holy Eucharist, excuse me. This was published in 1846, only 2 years after a revised edition of The Anxious Bench. And this was a further effort to try to bolster the catechetical piety that Nevin wanted to encourage. And so one part of his argument, and a very convoluted part of it, it seems to me, unless you know a lot about Hegelianism, is to talk about the meaning of the incarnation. And he looked at the institutional church as the embodiment of Christ in this age of the church. And to look at the church as the embodiment of Christ, the body of Christ, but he wanted to really push that idea, he drew a lot from German philosophy. For Nevin, then, the incarnation was the principle and source of a new spiritual order of life for humanity itself and the church. And so this view of union with Christ led to a much higher view of the church and its ministry in Nevin's conception. And so this also led to Nevin's assertion of Christ's real presence in the Lord's Supper, though it was a spiritual kind of real presence. And he wanted to assert that the sacrament was both a seal and a sign. Everyone agreed that it was a sign, but he also wanted to push on the idea that it was a seal of the invisible grace that it represents. But he believed that the American church, thanks to revivalism, had lost touch with this importance of the Lord's Supper. And so he wrote, "Low views of the sacrament betray invariably a low view of the mystery of the incarnation itself and a low view of the church also, as that new and higher order of life in which the power of this mystery continues to reveal itself through all ages." And then he quoted from Calvin for support. Calvin wrote, "They are preposterous who allow in this matter nothing more than that they have been able to reach with the measure of their understanding regarding the supper. When they deny that the flesh and blood of Christ are exhibited to us in the Holy Supper, define the mode, they say, or you will not convince us. But as for myself, I am filled with amazement at the greatness of the mystery, nor am I ashamed with Paul to confess in admiration my own experience, for how much better it is that to extenuate with my carnal sense what the apostle pronounces a high mystery." So again, the point here is that Nevin is finding support for Christ's real presence in the supper from Calvin. And of course, Calvin's view was very much contested in Switzerland. He had to go and try to make amends with Bullinger in 1840s and 50s, both for political reasons, but also over the disagreements over the Lord's Supper. So it's not as if Calvin's view is the dominant one in the Reformed faith, but still, Nevin is appealing to Calvin for support. But Hodge then responded, and they have a lengthy back and forth. Hodge reviews the mystical presence. Nevin shoots back with articles in the Mercersburg Review. Hodge shoots back with more articles in the Princeton Review. Since they were editors of these reviews, they could go back and forth with each other this way. Today we just have blogs, but and it's remarkable how quickly they could respond without the internet. They responded quite quickly. Today, if you get an article accepted in a journal, it usually takes about 18 months for it to come out. So Hodge took issue with Nevin's philosophy. And he also believed that Nevin left many Reformed doctrines hanging, especially doctrines of the imputation of Christ and election. And I think Hodge had a point when he saw too much of Schleiermacher at work in Nevin's reflections. But when it came to history, and this is where the debate turned after they debated theology and philosophy, when it came to history, it seems to me Nevin got the better of Hodge in understanding where Reformed history went. He actually could marshal more evidence, and eventually Nevin forced Hodge to call Calvin's views of the supper extreme, peculiar, and dubious. That was Hodge's view of Calvin's on the supper. So, as I say, they went back and forth on this, and it led to a great disruption between these two Reformed institutions, Princeton Seminary and Mercersburg, between these two former colleagues, Hodge and Nevin. So then, in conclusion, what is the significance of these debates for Reformed Protestantism and Presbyterianism in the United States? As I've indicated, Princeton and Mercersburg drifted apart, and the PCUSA, Hodge's denomination, and Nevin's former denomination, and the Reformed Church in the U.S., or the German Reformed, also drift apart. And it's interesting, when the German Reformed eventually lose their ethnicity, the mainstream Anglo-American church that they join is not a Presbyterian body, but the United Church of Christ, which is unbelievable when you think that Nevin's legacy goes into a Puritan tradition, a tradition that he didn't like the Puritans a whole lot. So it's just one of the great ironies. So the UCC stands for John Winthrop, John Williamson Nevin, and Jeremiah Wright, if you want to put those all together. Again, one of the many oddities of history when you look at it very, very closely. But it's important to see that the tension between Princeton and Mercersburg, or between Hodge and Nevin, was not caused by Finney, but actually prompted by their responses to Finney. So one way of trying to interpret this debate is to look at the common three-part division that we use to understand the various kinds of Reformed Protestantism. And here, following George Marsden, we can divide the Reformed world up into the doctrinalists, those who emphasize doctrine and subscription, the culturalists, those who emphasize cultural transformation, we may associate them with Neo-Calvinism and Kuyper, and the experimentalists or experientialists, we may associate them with Banner of Truth. Hodge is obviously in the doctrinal camp. What's also important to see of these three figures, Finney fits in the culturalist model because he was not only an advocate of revival, but also an advocate of social and political reform. And James Bratt, a prominent historian at Calvin College of the Dutch Reformed tradition, actually says that the Kuyperians were far closer in sympathies to New School Presbyterians than they were to Old School Presbyterians. So where do we classify Nevin then? Well, he's not on the map. He's a liturgical kind of Reformed Protestant. He's so emphasizing worship and the Lord's Supper, but he doesn't fit into any of these other categories. And that, for me, is a puzzle. Why would we not include the church and sacraments in our understandings of the Reformed tradition? Why would we only go to doctrine, culture, or experience? And I keep puzzling over this. It's not clear. Well, let me just back up and just say, Nevin, for all of his faults, is worth studying precisely for this reason, for trying to recover a high view of the church and sacraments. And I want to emphasize he got a lot of stuff wrong. But he also saw a real weakness in Reformed Protestantism, particularly among Presbyterians. So I think it's valuable studying Nevin for that reason. But it's still not clear to me, having thought about this controversy, why doctrine and liturgy, or doctrine and the Lord's Supper, would have to go in separate directions, which is what they did historically. Hodge and Nevin both represented, it seems to me, important and legitimate strands of the Reformed faith. Sacraments and doctrine have been very important in the life of the Reformed and Presbyterian churches. So it's not clear to me why you would have to choose one over the other. And it also seems to me that choosing one over the other has been a colossal mistake for our churches and the health of Reformed Protestantism more generally. And this goes back then to Finney. Finney's revivals, in my estimation, threatened more than simply old school Presbyterians' federal theology. He also threatened, as Nevin, I think, rightly saw, Reformed piety. He exalted feelings and subjectivity over the means of grace and sound teaching. So we see this today, where we still oftentimes evaluate worship services to the degree to which we felt something versus the degree to which we actually offered up our worship and praise to God. So a major factor in this debate then was a new conception of conversion that had emerged, I would argue, at least in the 18th century, probably goes back even beyond that into the practical divinity of the Puritans and the Dutch Second Reformation. But this new understanding of conversion, I think, set into motion this kind of division between doctrine and liturgy and the kind of piety that comes through a high view of the church and the supper. If you look in the 16th century, you can see when the Heidelberg Catechism, for instance, talks about conversion, it talks about conversion as virtually synonymous with sanctification. It's a lifelong process of living to Christ and dying to sin, mortification and vivification. And by the 18th century, though, conversion has become an instantaneous moment where someone moves from agony to ecstasy. And it's striking if you read Edward's own account of his conversion, compare it to people who are less Calvinistic. They oftentimes use very similar language. So this is what also split 18th century Presbyterians into the old and new sides. The new side was insisting that prospective ministers display a conversion experience in order to become ordained in the church. The old side was willing to accept a credible profession of faith as an indication that this candidate before them was a member in good standing in their churches and didn't need to give an account of his conversion experience, especially if he didn't have a conversion experience. Because it is possible for a child to grow up never having known otherwise than that they were a child of God. The plan of union, though, gave a blessing to this new idea of conversion, tried to work out the difficulties between the old side and new side, but the plan of union of 1758 that brings back together the old side and new sides sets into motion the expectation that Charles Hodge is going to have a conversion. And Nick, I understand, talked about this more this morning, and Hodge's mother's account of that may also then, I may need to temper what I'm saying. But let me close with a long quotation from John Williamson Nevin in his memoirs that I think sets up into motion this tension between what Reformed Protestants had done in their understanding of the ministry of the church and the way to rear children up into the nurture and admonition of the Lord and lead them to make profession of faith. And the great contrast that he experienced when a conversion was expected of him at Union College. And again, it seems to me that the debates among Hodge, Finney, and Nevin relate very much to this shift among Reformed Protestants on piety and the importance of conversion to that piety. So let me just read some of this excerpt from Nevin's memoir. Being of what is called Scotch-Irish extraction, I was by birth and blood also a Presbyterian. And as my parents were both conscientious and exemplary professors of religion, I was, as a matter of course, carefully brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord according to the Presbyterian faith as it then stood. I say with purpose as it then stood, for I cannot help seeing and feeling that a very material change has come upon since. And this is, in a way, not without serious interest for my own religious life. What I mean will appear at once when I state that the old Presbyterian faith into which I was born was based throughout on the idea of covenant family religion, church membership by God's holy act in baptism, and following this, a regular catechetical training of the young with direct reference to their coming to the Lord's table. In one word, all proceeded on the theory of sacramental educational religion as it had belonged properly to all the national branches of the Reformed Church in Europe from the beginning. In this respect, the Reformed Churches of Switzerland, France, Germany, Holland, and Scotland were of one mind, and this mind still ruled at the time to which I now refer, the Presbyterianism of this country. And then he goes on to talk about his experience at college. We had no religion in college, as far as morning and evening prayers went, and we were required on Sundays to attend the different churches in town, but there was no real church life as such in the institution itself. All this involved, of course, although alas I did not know it then, a very serious falling away from the educational and churchly scheme of religion in which I had been previously born and bred. It was my very first contact with the genius of New England Puritanism in its character of contradiction to the old Reformed faith as I had been baptized into it in its Presbyterian form. It is hardly necessary to say that circumstanced as I then was, I had no power to withstand the shock. It brought to pass what amounted for me to a complete breaking up of all my previous Christian life. For I had come to college as a boy of pious dispositions and exemplary religious habits, much like Hodge, never doubting but that I was in some way a Christian, though it had not come with me yet, unfortunately, to what is called a public profession of religion. But now one of the first lessons inculcated on me, indirectly by this unchurchly system, was that all this must pass for nothing, that I must learn to look upon myself as an outcast from the family and kingdom of God before I could come to be in either in the right way. Such especially was the instruction I came under when a revival of religion, as it was called, made its appearance among us and brought all to a practical point. For I, along with others, came into their hands in anxious meetings and underwent the torture of their mechanical counsel and talk. One after another, however, the anxious obtained hope, each new case, as it were, stimulating another, and finally, among the last, I struggled into something of the sort myself, a feeble, trembling sense of comfort, which my spiritual advisors then had no difficulty in accepting as all the case required. In this way, I was converted and brought into the church, as if I had been altogether out of it before, about the close of my 17th year. My conversion was not fully up to my own idea at the time of what such a change should be, but it was as earnest and thorough, no doubt, as that of any of my fellow converts. It was based throughout on the principle that regeneration and conversion lay outside the church, had nothing to do with baptism and Christian education, required rather a looking away from all this as more a bar than a process, than a help to the process, and were to be sought only in the way of magical elapse or stroke from the Spirit of God. In other words, the revivals undermine the very means of grace that Presbyterians talk about in the shorter, larger catechisms and the confession itself. So, to draw this to a conclusion, it seems to me that this division between the liturgical kind of Reformed Protestantism that Nevin was advocating and the kind of doctrinal faithfulness that Hodge himself was also educating was a very serious division within the Reformed ranks, especially at a very bad time when it happened, when Finney's new measures were gaining more and more ground in American Protestantism. And if they had come together, they may have been able to withstand some of the shock of that anxious bench, and they also may have been able to hold on to many more covenant children than they eventually did. And this is one of the great problems it seems to me we have in our churches, is how do we hold on to our covenant children. So I will stop there on that depressing note, but that's what historians do.